From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There was a time when rock stars roamed the earth, when the energy and impact of top musicians flooded beyond stadiums and studios and in many ways drove the culture. These were stars whose music defined their time. Think Jimmy and Janis, James Brown and John Lennon, Dylan, The Dead and The Stones. But times change, and so says my guest today, has the role of pop music itself and the people who make it. Since the pushback to stadium glam of grunge and the personalization of music and downloads with downloads and iPods, the world-straddling rock star has left the building. And the sway of pop music, he says, has gone from mass to niche. This hour, On Point, the death of the rock star and the changing role of pop music in America. You can join the conversation. Do you buy the argument that the great age of the rock star is behind us? Are we all lost in our own personal earbud concerts now? With 50 Cent and White Stripes, Coldplay and Amy Winehouse, what's changed with the role of popular music? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me first today from Pittsburgh is David Shumway, professor of cultural studies and literature at Carnegie Mellon University. He's working on a book about rock stars as cultural icons. He wrote an article in this month's Chronicle of Higher Education, the Hipsters Hangout, called Where Have All the Rock Stars Gone? David Shumway, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
We expected this maybe out of Rolling Stone, maybe not in the Chronicle of Higher Education, but it's a compelling and really interesting case that you make. When you say the rock star's gone, define that thing that you see as having left the building.
Well, it's exactly the rock star as cultural icon who I think is on the wane. There certainly are people who stand out among other performers, and they are stars to their audiences. But the latest generation of performers has not risen to the level of stardom that the earlier generation had, or indeed the level of stardom that the great movie stars of the 30s and 40s had during that era.
Let's get a little bit of the sound of that in our ears. We've got a lot of music out there and fans of musicians today who may or may not agree, but here it is, of course, the famous one, 1965, Shea Stadium, August, the Beatles.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, honored by their country, decorated by their queen, and loved here in America, here are the Beatles.
And it still just about splits the eardrums. Okay, they were incredibly popular. Everybody was on the same page, or at least that crowd was, cheering for these folks. But it wasn't, or was it, just the number of fans you're talking about here? When you say cultural icon, what do you mean? Give us some more definition on what sets those apart from what we see now. There are still big music stars.
Well, when the Beatles appeared at Shea Stadium, they had already performed on the Ed Sullivan Show and drawn record ratings. And it's because everybody, it seemed, tuned in that Sunday night to hear the Beatles, and several Sunday nights, actually, prior to those big stadium shows, that they seemed to be a national phenomenon. And first, it wasn't so much the music. People talked more about their hair than they did about the music. But everybody was talking about them. If you were a teenager then, there was nothing more important than the Beatles. But the interesting thing is it wasn't just teenagers. I mean, parents didn't like them, but they were also talking about them. Doesn't seem to be happening quite that way today, because there isn't the equivalent, I would argue, of the Ed Sullivan Show. There's no one place where a star can emerge in that way. Even yeah. American Idol, which might be the closest thing, reaches a much, much smaller audience, percentage of the audience, despite its popularity.
So part of what you're looking at here is format, and that's related to technology. There you had everybody gathered around, I guess in those days, mainly the black and white TV, or around the radio, or around the stereo, kind of collective listening, as opposed now to iPods and earbuds and private concerts. The other part of your argument, I guess, is political, that you had rock stars come along who sowed the message in their music way out beyond the traditional realm of music and made it something really important to the whole political culture of the country.
I think that's right, and it actually happened originally more or less by accident. Elvis Presley certainly never intended to present himself as a political figure, but because of the way he performed, he violated all kinds of cultural boundaries, gender, race, and class. He was a overtly working-class white kid singing in a black style, mm-hmm. and dancing in a way that men hadn't done before in public, or at least white men hadn't done in public. Mm. So he immediately became controversial. And in addition, he became a symbol of a generation. He was a rallying point for youth. And it's really in the 50s that the idea of youth as a separate group with its own identity in the United States becomes widely prevalent. There are, of course, some earlier moments, the 1920s, when certain young people thought of themselves in that way. But in the 50s, it becomes much more widespread. And that sets the basis for the youth politics of the 1960s. And it's really the music that is the single most important factor that holds that identity group together. It's what everyone, regardless of their different shades of political opinion, shares, or everyone who would identify him or herself with the youth movement.
Maybe starting with Elvis shaking those hips and being kind of a living, breathing challenge to the status quo, you get that big wall of screams for the Beatles, and around the same time you've got Bob Dylan becoming very explicit, first of all becoming electric and rock, but also wholly political.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that.
Bob Dylan, 1965, with Like a Rolling Stone, not the peak of stardom, but the politicization and the moment you say where everything got plugged in, where music became absolutely core to the culture's sense of itself. So where did that go? What's the peak of the phenom that you're talking about in the rock star as you see it, David Shumway?
Well, the peak, I would say, is probably the early 70s, with the Rolling Stones emerging as the leading celebrities in any entertainment field. But a lot of things happened in the meantime. You mentioned James Brown, very important, creates a Black Power anthem, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Mm. Aretha Franklin, With Respect, creates a feminist anthem out of what was essentially a love song written by Otis Redding. You get the Grateful Dead and other members of the San Francisco sound developing in their music a sense of a countercultural politics and advocacy of mind-altering drugs. So a lot happens, but it all, I think, comes together in some way in the emergence of the Rolling Stones as they called themselves and everybody accepted the world's greatest rock and roll band, but also especially Mick Jagger, the biggest celebrity.
So with that, it kind of peaks out in the 70s, but the star is a long time going. We got big hair bands in the 80s and an awful lot of glam. But by the time we come up to 2007, you look out on a nation of earbuds and kind of private concerts going on. And you say that not just the stars have left the building, but the cultural position of popular music itself has diminished. We're going to hear from a 20-something music critic in a minute to get her feedback on that. But where do you see the state of popular music now compared to that peak you're talking about, let's say, in the early 70s, and its sway?
Well, it's diminished because it's now largely niche music. The significance of the charts, especially the singles charts, is much less. I mean, they represent significant sales, certainly, still. But in the 60s, it mattered widely who was selling the most records. Today, I would guess most people don't know who's selling the most records in the way that they now do know which movies are the biggest box office. And that's an interesting change in itself. So it's important to specify that I'm not saying music is less important. I think music continues to be very important to people. It's just that people are listening to different musics.
And so it's spread all over the map, and the impact spread with it. David Shumway, please stand by. We're talking about the end of rock stars and the changing role of popular music in American culture. You can join the conversation. Where have the giants gone? James Brown right here. Elvis, the Beatles, the Dead, the rock stars who straddled and lit up the whole culture. Do you buy the thesis? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the end of the age of rock stars. Bruce Springsteen there, 1985, live, born in the USA, and he clearly is doing that rock star thing. But is it still happening today? Or are we all fragmented into our little, earbud pods, our iPod buds? My guest, David Shumway, at Carnegie Mellon University, has written an article, Where Have All the Rock Stars Gone? He says, popular music itself has been diminished by changes in culture, changes in technology. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is the rock superstar dead now? Is it all about the niche, the hip little band nobody's heard of, or maybe just you and your friends? Has collective adulation gotten lost in iPods and earbuds and concerts? For one, do top musicians even aspire to be superstars anymore, or something else? Has what we value changed? 800-423-8255 is our number. It's 800-423-TALK. David Shumway joins us today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I want to invite in a couple of other guests here to broaden this conversation. From New York City, Amanda Petrusich is with us. She's a contributing writer for Pitchfork. It's a hip internet magazine, covers the latest in the contemporary music scene. Amanda, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
And also from New York City, Anthony DeCurtis is with us, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He's interviewed many of the huge rock figures of recent decades, right back to Paul McCartney and Bono and Bruce Springsteen. He was with us recently talking about Sgt. Pepper, and we're delighted to have him back. Anthony DeCurtis, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Amanda, let us come straight to you first. You're 27 years old. You look at music all the time. David Shumway says, hey, you know what? Rock stars are dead. You don't have them anymore. Popular music has changed. What do you say?
Well, I think if we're defining rock stars as people who play rock music, then yes, I mean, certainly that particular archetype has changed because I think rock music has changed. You know, it's no longer nearly as outrageous or as dangerous as it once was. I mean, for my generation, and I was born in 1980,
yeah.
Rock music is what our parents listened to. I mean, playing guitar-based, melodic, rhythmic music in 2007 is not a subversive act. You know, if anything, it's the opposite. And I think at a certain point in the last 30 years, rock music became the status quo. So rather than rock being a revolution in and of itself, it's now what artists push against.
You know, to be fair, I think he's not looking, though, to point taken, rock itself has become not outrageous anymore. But I don't think it's so much the music as the form, the rock stardom, the form and scale of what was rock stardom. He, and I read him saying, whatever style, if it's hip-hop or you name it, people aren't filling those kind of shoes anymore or even aspiring to. What do you think?
Sure. Well, absolutely. I mean, I think I unfortunately belong to a generation of music fans who appreciate things ironically. You know, I mean, controlled disinterest is sort of the new setting your guitar on fire. And I think starting certainly in the early 90s with grunge, there was resistance to that kind of deification, that kind of super stardom. You know, artists like Eddie Vedder and Kurt Cobain wore $3 flannel shirts and ripped jeans and refused to participate in their own celebrity. And I mean, at their live shows, they jumped off stage and into the audience, you know, quite literally breaking down the barrier between fan and artist. And that behavior may have been its own kind of posturing, but for whatever reason, they actively disavowed fame. And I think that's endured in a way through certain emo and punk artists. I think when you go to see, you know, someone like Bright Eyes, it's not going to be pyrotechnics. It's not arena rock. It's this, you know, this little guy in a little hooded sweatshirt, you know, sort of trembling on stage. I mean, you can be his MySpace friend. You know, it's that kind of everyman aesthetic has certainly been embraced by independent music. And I think if you past members of, you know, Pavement or Sonic Youth or the Arcade Fire on the street, you probably wouldn't turn your head, you know, and bravado is sort of frowned upon now, and ego is frowned upon. It's sort of not cool in the same way that maybe it once was.
Let's get the sound of Nirvana, maybe, and that turning point, 1993, All Apologies in our ears. Here it is.
What else should I be?
There came Nirvana and grunge and the anti-hero, maybe. Anthony DeCurtis at Rolling Stone, you've been listening and talking to people for a long time. What do you see changed here? Is it just or mainly, as Amanda says, that bravado is out? Or is there something else, something bigger that's changed, been lost? I don't know how you want to put it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I thought Amanda actually defined it pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, there was that sense, I mean, that moment of transition where maybe, like, presaged by, like, say, somebody like Michael Stipe, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, where, okay, you're Kurt Cobain, you know, Nirvana's the biggest thing around. You know, here's the crown, Kurt. He doesn't want it. Okay, he kills himself. And then, you know, here's Eddie Vedder. Okay, you know, your band's the biggest thing around. Here's the crown. He doesn't want it. You know, and this kind of... it's sort of like art of refusal, and this, I think, very much is a reaction to some of the grandness and, you know, whatever, you know, there are probably a more negative terms to use for it, of that we saw in the 80s, where, you know, even, you know, stars like Springsteen, I mean, who is somebody whom I admire a great deal, but there was a kind of scale that he achieved that was a little bit off-putting, and I think that, I mean, I certainly don't want to speak for Amanda, but I think that many people her age, when they think of Bruce, they don't really think of, say, the guy who made Nebraska particularly, or the guy who did Darkness at the Edge of Town. What they see, and what maybe they grew up seeing, was, you know, this guy on stage in a T-shirt and a bandana, you know, with a stadium full of people screaming Born in the USA and, you know, muscle bound and all this other business. So I think that, you know, in terms of rock and roll itself, you know, there was that process. I guess the question I would raise is something lost? I mean, if we, you know, it's fabulous to just have, you know, a lot. I mean, certainly we have more music now probably than we've ever had.
Download it from all over, yeah.
Yeah, and more interesting stuff maybe even. But, you know, if everybody, you know, if part of what rock and roll, it seems to me, always represented was, you know, this kind of communality. And if that's lost, you know, then maybe something really pretty essential is lost. You know, I mean, that at least is the question. That's what I miss, yeah. I suppose.
That's a great question, David Shumway. What about it? Is it just bravado and grandeur lost, or something more important to your mind? And I don't know if lost is the right word or changed. You tell us.
I think it's the possibility of communication that's lost. the stars of the 60s and 70s had the ability to make statements, to criticize the culture in a way that a lot of people heard. And I think what's lost more recently is that these artists don't have the ear of large numbers of people, and so their cultural force is diminished.
But artists have millions of ears. I mean, they're right in their ears with their earbuds and iPods, surely communicating.
But only to small fractions of the population who may not even be aware of each other. I mean, as I say in the article, my students all know the music of my youth, but they don't tend to know the music of the current moment, or at least they don't know the same music.
Does it matter, Amanda? Do you feel proudly inhabiting lots of little islands of music? Do you agree that there's this, ignorance of a shared communal body of musical culture now?
Well, I absolutely agree with David that popular culture isn't nearly as centralized as it once was. But I also think in a way that niche cultures have always existed. I mean, there have always been, you know, hippies and burnouts and future business leaders. And I think kids have always self-identified through music and have done so by sort of embracing the aesthetic of fandom, which is exclusive by nature. I mean, teenagers are preoccupied with self-definition, or at least, you know, I know I was. And it's actually relatively easy, I think, to identify yourself through music fandom, you know, through a niche. Whether it's rockabilly or punk or glam or grunge or, you know, emo or hip-hop, there's this kind of built-in attitude, there's a built-in fashion, there's a built-in ideology. It's a kind of identity in a box. And it's a relatively easy way of establishing in public your character. And I think that kind of sort of niche listening has always existed in a way. But I do think David makes a good point about, you know, music being more disposable now and less communal and more private. I mean, I think that's certainly true.
You know, let's listen for just a minute to Bono, still a pretty big star. We should think about what his example means. Also able to smell which way the wind is blowing pretty well. Here's a bit from a 1985 interview after a concert in the Meadowlands. U2's frontman saying that the image of the rock and roll star didn't fit him, didn't fit his band. Denial of stardom is what Bono's going with here.
I think we make very bad rock and roll stars, U2. I think one of the myths about this group is that, you know, that we're going to make anthemic-like music, you know. It's the triumph, you know. Bono stands there, you know, soldier poet, his head held high. You know, the truth is rather the opposite. I think our audience know us even more than we know ourselves, and they see in U2 a band that's fallen on its face so many times.
Bono, no mean star himself, denying stardom there already in 1985. Let's get a call from Rachel in Medford, Massachusetts. Rachel, you're on the air.
Wow. Good afternoon. I just really resonate with what Anthony DeCurtis said about the sort of loss of communality of music, particularly recently with the 40th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and then also the anniversary of Aretha Franklin's Respect. There's not a lot of music these days that can talk to different groups of people, particularly young people. I'm only 35, but when I've worked with youth, the music that I could rely on to talk to them about was, you know, music from the 60s, because I knew that they for sure would know who the Beatles were, or they knew who, you know, James Brown was and things like that from, you know, either sampling, you know, from hip-hop artists or, you know, other artists just...
And what about the music of their contemporaries, Rachel?
You know what? A lot of things have changed. Music is more, you know, more personal. It's more... You know, more snobby, to be lack of a better word.
What did you say? It's more what?
It's more snobby.
Snobby.
You know, it's people go, oh, I listen to this, but I won't listen to this. You know, when I was growing up, yeah, we listened to, you know, we listened to hip hop, we
right.
listened to jazz, we listened to classical music. You know, till this day, I still quote, you know, Duke Ellington saying there's only two types of music. Good music and bad music. And I don't think that really translates in today's music culture.
Rachel, let us pick that up. And Amanda, let me come to you if I may. I mentioned to some a young friend that I was talking to somebody from Pitchfork. He said, oh, they're so snobby. It's a kind of, you know, musical elitism. So what is it? Are you more discriminating, more personal, more snobby? Is mainstream music, which was celebrated in the 60s and 70s, is it not good enough anymore? Is it the industry's fault? What?
Oh, gosh, I hope I'm not snobby. I do think that, you know, as I was saying earlier, I think part of that is, and part of this kind of ability to be, you know, very discerning about things, is that music is more disposable now than it once was. You know, I mean, I used to, and I'm sure David and Anthony can relate, I used to spend, you know, even when I was a kid, whole weekends looking for specific records, and now it's, you know, it's three clicks on iTunes, it's three clicks on Amazon. You know, you used to have to make an investment in an album, and now you can kind of sample, you know, 30 seconds of every track online and then just sort of buy the, you know, the songs that sound good to you immediately.
But it does seem that it's no longer cool to be into mainstream music. Do you think that's because mainstream is corrupted somehow, or that it's just out of tune with a more personalized era, generation?
You know, I don't know that I agree that it's not cool to be into mainstream music. I think maybe that was sort of true in the beginnings of independent music in the, you know, in the early 80s and 90s. Now, so I think that most listeners of independent music are sort of embracing pop music. I think some of the artists on the radio now, you know, I mean, people like Justin Timberlake, Missy Elliott, Timbaland, Jay-Z, I mean, I think that they, in many ways, are sort of the most compelling, the most revolutionary artists working right now. And I think independent music fans are starting to kind of realize that.
Anthony DeCurtis, what about it? Rachel sees the communality behind us as a loss. Can it be offset by the gain of many different musicians celebrating in their own niche?
Well, look, I mean, some of this, I mean, people want communal experiences and they're going to find them. You know, maybe they're not going to find them with music necessarily. You know, they might look for them in other places. I have no question that young people and older people, for that matter, you know, they still want to feel, you know, that rush of you know, just being part of a group that's really, you know, kind of being uplifted by something. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any, you know, to me, there's no doubt that some version of that's going to happen, whether it happens in music or not, I think is really the question.
David Shumway, still happening there? You say basically not. You say everybody's off on their own beam.
Well, I agree with Anthony that young people will find other basis for communal experience. You know, I think that this change in stardom that I'm talking about shouldn't necessarily be read perhaps a major crisis. Stardom has changed in the past, and it will doubtless change again, and music will change. I mean, the fact that people are still listening, young people are still listening to the artists of the 60s and 70s, is amazing if you consider the longer history of popular music, where generational tastes tended to shift predictably. I certainly didn't listen to the music of my parents' generation when I was growing up. And yet this generation is listening to the music of their grandparents' generation in some cases.
It is pretty amazing. It is pretty amazing. Technology changes, culture changes, and we look out on Anthony DeCurtis at Rolling Stone, Amanda Petrusich at Pitchfork, and David Shumway. His piece is Where Have All the Rock Stars Gone? Please stand by. Here's Led Zeppelin with The Ocean, 1973, Madison Square Garden. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Do top musicians aspire to be superstars anymore? Have rock stars as cultural icons gone the way of vinyl LPs? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress at Rite Aid GNC and Duane Reade, and RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles, 617-859-0540.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the end of the age of rock stars. Who else but a rock star? Jimi Hendrix, 1969 at Woodstock. We're looking at the changing role of popular music in American culture. David Shumway is with us. Anthony DeCurtis of Rolling Stone. Amanda Petrusic at Pitchfork.com is here. You can join us as well. What about Jay-Z and Coldplay and Beyonce? Aren't they the new rock stars? Is this just a boomer diss on a new era? Or has something really changed here? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let's go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to call and say I'm 54 years old and kind of obviously was the tail end of the Elvis era, but came of age during the 60s and early 70s.
Yeah.
And a week ago, I took my three 20-some-year-old sons to a Bob Dylan concert, and you talk about a communal experience that was just that transcended all of the, you know, rock expectations and niche music expectations.
Did they agree, or was that just 54-year-old dad sailing high there?
Absolutely. They couldn't have had a better time. And one of my sons talked about a TV concert he had seen of one of these, you know, 70s revival bands and described it as a bunch of, you know, fat old men in tight-fitting T-shirts.
a lot of those out there.
And Bob Dylan came out as a statesman, my son referred to him as. But again, he's in a category kind of all by himself.
Yeah, but he set us off on a path. Amanda Petrusic, when you listen to Bob Dylan, look at Bob Dylan, hear him, you know, in his old concerts or today, do you see something from another era, another age?
Well, I love Bob Dylan. in fact, I'm routinely mocked by my peers for my obsession with Bob Dylan. I think he's someone who certainly has endured in ways that are maybe more relevant even than people like Paul McCartney. You know, I think his new records are good, and that's kind of the big difference. You know, he's really sort of succeeded, I think, in updating his sound and remaining relevant to a whole new generation of fans. I mean, and I absolutely agree with the caller. You know, he's riveting live, and, you know, perhaps always will be, and not in the same way that, you know, the fat guys in tight T-shirts are.
Okay, but here's a guy who's not a fat guy in a T-shirt. Why shouldn't he be considered as just as big? Jay-Z, Dirt Off Your Shoulder. This is crazy, baby. Don't forget that boy told you kick that dirt off your shoulders. I'm probably over the yard. Probably be locked by the force. Trying to hustle some things that go with the push. Feeling no remorse. Feeling like my hand was okay, forced. Anthony DeCurtis, here's hip hop. It has made a huge noise. It's made a bunch of stars. Rock stars? Do they belong in the age of rock stars brackets?
Well, you know what? I mean, I do really think hip hop has much benefited by rock and roll sort of refusing to, the metaphor I was using before was kind of wear the crown, you know, because they're perfectly happy to be larger than life and be big and sell a lot of records and occupy that public space, you know, they really enjoy that. It's funny, though, I mean, I think that, one thing I noticed a few years ago, I was reading a piece in Vibe, and they kept referring to, a couple of guys who were in the story kept referring to, you know, this other rapper as a rock star. And to them, that term meant just absurdly self-indulgent. You know, that, you know, their goals, and I think Jay-Z's goals, are almost like more like to be a CEO. I mean, Jay-Z is a great artist and a great writer and a great rapper. You know, but, I mean, I think he really sees himself kind of as a businessman and sees the artistry as, you know, kind of something that you do and that you also maybe grow out of. And, you know, that the more mature thing is to kind of run that company. And that plus the fact of, content, which I think, you know, has been troublesome, you know, I think for a lot of people.
What do you mean? Oh, you mean the
yeah,
language,
you know,
the sexism
kind of, you know,
and
the violence, yeah. The misogyny, all that business, which, yeah, I mean, there are ways to talk about that. I mean, it's a complex issue.
Yeah.
I don't mean to dismiss it, but, you know, it makes a lot of people nervous. And so it also isn't going to be, you know, the kind of thing that's going to propel you into, you know, being nominated for the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, David Shumway, what about hip-hop and its stars? Ready to wear the crown, Anthony DeCurtis says, but in a different way. So does it qualify? Does it fill the role or not?
Well, I think hip-hop, as Anthony said, hip-hop performers are happy to be stars, but because of some of the issues Anthony mentioned, the content of the music, but also its form, I think it's... hard for some people of all generations to accept the form that hip-hop comes in, which is music that's principally rhythmic and vocal and not with no instrumental and often the lacking melody. Those components are still what many people expect from music. I think if we had had broader mass media, more people might have gotten used to that form of music, and hip-hop might have come to dominate the public consciousness in the same way that rock and roll did earlier. But because of these various inhibiting factors, it became important, and I would argue it's the most aesthetically important innovation in music of the past 20 years. But it's... But it has not reached the audience it might have.
Also, it may be about love or suffering, but it's about love and suffering in Compton. I mean, it's kind of place and culture specific in a way that the blues and jazz and rock ultimately spread beyond. Let's go to Beaufort, South Carolina. Dustin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't know. I just feel that there's a musical overload. I mean, they're cramming so much stuff down our throats nowadays that you know. You don't really have a choice but to listen to the stuff they give us, and people just, I don't know, I guess lost their drive. Nobody sings or performs about what they used to. They used to have a purpose behind their music. Now it's, you know, what kind of messages are we sending to people?
Well, what does it feel like? I mean, it must have some sort of purpose or not when you listen. What do you hear?
I don't know. It's kind of like the stupidization of America. It's you know, you got songs like Lip Gloss and this and that. You know, what kind of message is that sending? And people used to sing about political issues and you know, treating others and this and that, and they just don't really do it anymore.
Dustin, thanks. Amanda, the stupidization of America, what do you say?
Well, I agree that music has certainly become less political, and in some ways music has become more professional. But, you know, I mean, what was Hound Dog about? You know, I mean, there have always been sort of frivolous pop songs, and I think there always will be.
Andrew, in Northampton, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'd like to propose that rock or pop music has gone from being a cultural force to an economic one. I mean, for my generation, REM moving to a big label was a huge deal, and hair bands weren't really popular. They were just on MTV.
And so what? That means that the soul has gone out of it? They're not stars because they don't set out with the same aspiration in the first place? It's just money?
No, I'd argue that boomers are so self-involved and so self-aggrandizing that they insist on people being pop stars and selling a lot of albums and so on.
So let it go, maybe, if it just turns into economic status. Anthony DeCurtis, did the money run away with the flame somehow?
Well, you know, money became, I mean, look, I don't think anybody ever tried to become a rock star to be poor, you know? I mean, even the most idealistic ones. Yeah. I mean, that comment by Bono before was hilarious.
I mean, really.
U2 has always been hugely ambitious, and he knows that, you know? But that said, I mean, I think the possibilities of wealth and the kinds of divisions of wealth, you know, that we've seen in this country, let alone in popular music, I mean, since, well, probably, you know, 1980 or so, you know, certainly did affect the music. And I think, you know, one of the reasons the music industry is disintegrating so terribly is that, you know, it really did become almost exclusively about money, you know, through much of the 80s and into the 90s. So, you know, that's a factor. On the other hand, I always felt, I mean, I never particularly thought that it was a virtue to just have a few fans. I mean, certainly there are many artists I love that never had many fans, you know, but I sort of felt it was always better when they had more fans. I mean, I liked it when a lot of people liked stuff that I thought was good. And so, you know, I didn't particularly have that, you know, that point of view that, like, it, you know, if only me and my friends like this, that's right. Better than everybody liking it. I wanted everybody to like it.
So come on in and be part of it. Let's go to Nashville. And Jeff, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, I like the conversation a lot, and I was thinking about the earlier comment, and I'm comparing Jay-Z and whoever you played right before that. And
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix. I think one of the main things is, and speaking as a musician, is that there's no live instruments in much of current music, hip-hop especially, like taking Jay-Z, for example. And he's not inspiring young people to want to play an instrument, to want to pick up an instrument. I mean, Robert Johnson inspired Eric Clapton, and in turn, Eric Clapton inspired legions of people to want to play the guitar. And then subsequently, the bands he was in and those musicians inspired bass players and guitar players and keyboard players.
And it was visceral. It was in the fingertips, and you had to put your heart there.
Exactly. They're moving air, and I think that's so much of the problem today that I have, is that, you know, everything is so flat-sounding because it's played on a computer or on a keyboard, and you're not moving air.
Right.
You're not changing the molecules and changing people and changing the world in the process.
No, I understand it. There's the view straight from Nashville. Let us think on that while we listen for just a second to White Stripes, My Doorbell, 2005. Anthony DeCurtis, you hear the voice from Nashville saying we just don't have enough musicianship, not enough live instruments at work on the stage these days, and everything that comes with that.
Well, I go back and forth on that. I mean, I love live music, you know, and I mean, I love musicians. I mean, one of the great parts of my job is, you know, I'm just really fascinated by what they do. I mean, I'm not a player myself, but, you know, I like that instantaneous feel of, you know, just somebody making it happen right in front of you. On the other hand, I mean, there are just so many great sounds that have come out of hip-hop, and I sort of like their disdain for music often. You know, there's just a kind of, you know, there's a kind of rebelliousness to that, too, you know? This is, you know, it's not easy to make those records, you know? And, it really does involve a certain kind of talent. And, you know, you could put together, I mean, if you listen to a Public Enemy record, or you listen to, a Dre record or an Eminem record, I mean, those are just amazing sounding. So, you know, I certainly don't want to see, you know, musicianship disappear, but I would like to think of these other kind of skills as, you know, as coming along as well.
Let's go to Melissa in Boston. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd just like to say that I don't really mind if, you know, if an artist or a musician is amazingly popular. I think that, you know, the White Stripes happen to be one of my favorites. I just think that the cost and the process of trying to get tickets to go see them perform just kind of turns me off, and personally for me, it pushes me to seek my music in more, you know, smaller doses, so that I can go to small clubs and I can see people and experience them. Whereas if I can't even get a ticket in the first 10 minutes of the sale, you know, I'm not even going to retry ever.
So you're done with the whole stadium thing? No thanks, you don't need it.
Well, you know, I mean, and I still try sometimes, but, you know, it just never happens because I'm, you know, I refuse to pay extra money to be in a special club to get pre-sale status.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I would rather be able to just have my nice small band that, you know, I can go and see and be 20 feet away from, and that works for me.
Right, or click the download button and have them right in your ear. Let's get one more call from Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. I think that most of what is being said today is really on target, but I take a more critical view. I've been a music writer and critic for 25 years in the Boston area,
Yeah. And
I think that empty celebrity, celebrity without good calories, as Paul Simon said on PBS the other day, has killed the idea of a legitimate artist being huge, being a big media star. The whole thing has been corrupted. And I think the whole idea of artistic greatness is kind of dead today. I mean, when you say, hey, that's a great single, you don't mean today that it's truly great and soul-enhancing work of art. Mm. You mean, hey, that's a little catchy.
So, Daniel, name names. Who killed the rock star? Who brought the empty calories to the stage?
Well, I mean, you know, the Paris Hilton syndrome is the way you can say it most quickly.
But she scarcely makes music. What about musicians?
Excuse me?
But she hardly makes music. Are there musicians who personified this, who emptied the calories?
To be completely honest, I mean, I do think that the entire movement of hip-hop is completely fraudulent of true artistic greatness. And there's a lot of people saying, hey, this isn't even music. That's why we like it. We can be superior to art. We can own it. We can control it. And I think that the people in the streets as well as the magnates are kind of thinking this. Hey, let's not worry about making a great movie. Let's make a blockbuster and not even try to make it great and then make that incredibly popular.
Daniel, we've only got a minute, but we appreciate you saying what you think right there. Amanda, you know, the whole idea of artistic greatness, gone.
Well, I mean, I agree with this sort of idea of empty calories being, you know, perhaps more prevalent than it should be. I mean, it may be true that in 1956 everyone had an opinion on Elvis Presley, and 3 months ago everyone had an opinion on Britney Spears shaving her head. I think what's interesting is that ultimately what was controversial about Elvis was his music, and what's controversial about Britney is her lifestyle. However, I do think that, you know, hip-hop is hugely... you know, influential, and also I think its musicianship is routinely underestimated. I mean, I can't play drums, but I certainly can't rap either.
Yeah.
You know, and I have equal respect for both endeavors.
Well, it's been a fascinating exploration of where music's gone, maybe to a different place, maybe a lower profile. Still, it's in the earbuds and makes its difference there. Anthony DeCurtis at Rolling Stone, great to have you again. Thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
It was really a pleasure.
And Amanda Petrusich at Pitchfork. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
David Shumway at Carnegie Mellon University, you got us all started. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.